You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about the new intersection between our advice about dieting and how it's been impacted by the advent of these powerful new injectable weight loss drugs, seem to be oral weight loss drugs. They're coming up with more and more versions. They're seeing that there may be as many as 10 or 12 of these medications on the market, even more effective medications that can make you lose 12, 15, 20% of your body mass within a matter of a few months. They're very effective, but they've got some downsides. They're with us today, Kim Shapira, who has written a book called This Is What You're Really Hungry For, and she argues for more of an all-of-the-above approach. We can't simply rely on medications to address our problems with food that lead us to metabolic problems and weight gain. So, Kim, can you give us just sort of a brief resume of these six rules that you write about in This Is What You're Really Hungry For?
Sure. Okay, I'll try and be brief. Thanks for having me. The first rule, and I call them rules, kind of to trigger people, you know, right off the bat. The first rule is
rules. When you're... I don't want rules.
That's exactly right. Oh, no. Yeah, I think we have to face our fear head on because it's not that scary once we face it. You eat when you're hungry. You take your normal portion. You cut it in half. You wait 15 minutes and you come back and see if you need more food. Mm-hmm. Rule number two is to eat what you love with the caveat that the food has to love you back. Rule number three is to eat without distractions.
Well, let's start over there. Food loving you.
I was waiting for you to do that.
How does a food love you? I mean, yeah. I could see loving your food. That's the easy part.
Yeah.
What about the food loving you?
Well, if through the lens of you're in a relationship with food, okay? And so we often stay too long in relationships that are harmful to us. And the first part of the rule is to eat what you love. And there's a lot of shame and persecution around certain foods. I've heard people call food healthy, unhealthy. They can't eat it. They should eat it. And really, this rule is to help dispel any of that so you can start calling food food, so you can learn and move forward into actually understanding what is best for your body. And your body is changing. The caveat is to make sure the food loves you back. I don't know the actual percentage of people who are suffering from headaches, clearing their throat, heartburn, burping, bloating, stomach noises, gas, diarrhea, constipation, joint pain, psoriasis, eczema, foggy brain, fatigue, right? Related to the way that these foods are hitting your digestive tract and impacting your body and quality of life. And I really believe, and I'm sure you do too, that our body is absolutely amazing. My heart beats on its own. My mind thinks without me telling it to. It can heal itself. I just need to give it the space to do that. Right. And so that's what this rule is all about.
So this is an audio recording, but if you saw the video, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says it's fun to feel good. And the idea behind that is that, you know, whether or not you eat a food is not merely about its caloric impact or whether it's going to make you gain or lose weight. It's also about how the food makes you feel. And I think you have to be your own science fair project to some extent to experience whether a food has an adverse effect. So, I mean, if it's a one-off, you know, I ate this and I got a headache, well, you know, be a scientist and say, you know, repeat the experiment and see if indeed this is a headache trigger or if this is a trigger for GI problems. And then in that sense, the food is not your friend. And, you know, maybe you're better off avoiding it because it's fun to feel good.
It is fun to feel good.
It's not terrible. Fun to feel bad.
Yes. Yes. But people who don't really, or who think it's hard to do what other people are doing, like living, let's say, in air quotes, healthy lifestyle, mm-hmm. they look at that as hard. But the truth is, your t-shirt is right. Mm-hmm. It's just more fun to feel good. And so we, people who are living this lifestyle, don't think mm-hmm. it's hard. Yeah. Right? I mean, I got into this because I wanted to feel good when I didn't. Right? So, yeah, that rule is... So
give us some examples of some foods that you discovered really just are not a match for you that, you know, have some adverse effect.
Well, personal...
I love to eat that food. It just tastes great and I have a yen for that food, but it's just not worth it. It's not worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 51, so we can go way back, but I will tell you, I used to get migraines as a kid it was pretzels, I figured out, that always gave me migraines, and I never really figured out why. But it ended up figuring out that it was the malt, the ingredient malt in food that caused migraines. I got pneumonia when I was like 48, and I had to take 2 bouts of antibiotics, which, you know, is really, it's like 2 steps forward, 1 step back with your digestion when you take an antibiotic. And in this case, 2. And all of a sudden, I was finding that I had to run to the bathroom.
It just after destroys eating your microbiome.
Yeah. And I was eating foods I normally was eating. And it turns out at like 48, I became completely milk intolerant. And then the same thing kind of happened with blueberries. So there are foods that people would even call superfoods or healthy foods that were not healthy for me. And really, it's not that I need to take these foods out for the rest of my life. It's pointing the direction that I need to support my gut, and I need to make sure I'm adding foods that can help me heal whatever damage has taken place based on my lifestyle, my stress, antibiotic use, whatnot. And I'm happy to tell you, I had Kugel last night and I'm perfectly fine. And
you survived. You survived.
Well, I mean, my gut is healed. It doesn't mean that
it
I won't
mean it's a permanent, it's sometimes a temporary thing to allow the gut to heal. But
it took me years.
If you drink Kugel every night, maybe not so
good. I don't know how that would be. Yeah. I'm not going to do that. But like, it took years before I could bring milk back into my world. But like, you know, I don't have pretzels because I just avoid them. But I will find like a malt-free pretzel, you know, still. Blueberries, I have no problem with, you know, so.
It's a matter of a temporary cessation, like a bit of an elimination diet. Followed by recovery and then reintroduction.
Yeah. And recovery looks like, you know, omega-3s, a probiotic, some fermented foods, whole grains, and a diverse amount of fruits and vegetables, ones that you can tolerate that love you back. These are the ingredients that you really need, or the nutrients you really need to help that mucosal layer of your gut.
So you encourage your clients to be diet detectives and to kind of keep a little bit of a food diary, be aware of potential food reactions. And then sort them out.
Yeah, love it. Love it. Love figuring it out.
Good. So I think you're on number 3.
Yeah, number 3 is to eat without distraction. So we eat for hunger, which is really the reason I want people to eat. Mm-hmm. We eat because of emotional reasons. We eat because we, you know, are having a craving. And sometimes we eat just because the food is in front of us. And going forward, I really want people to be hungry when they eat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Figuring out the craving, what is hunger.
So in other words, try not to be watching the news or, you know, you're having an argument at the table or something like that.
That sounds like so if someone's like watching the news and they look forward to this every day or every evening, let's say, and they love getting on the couch and, you know, having whatever it is that they love to have, this is habit. This is not hunger. And this is really an opportunity to figure out what they really need in their life that they're not having in that moment.
So actually, I think we're getting into the theme that food is a relaxation response for some people. They don't know how to relax without food. An example of which, I'll give you an example. is, you know, after a really busy day in practice, I might see 10, 12 patients, very challenging, you know, and then a lot of paperwork. I'd come home and some days would be I would keep like some vodka in the refrigerator, my favorite lemon flavored vodka in the freezer. And it comes out like syrup when it's that cold. And some days it'd be like a one finger day. Some days it'd be a two finger day. Some days it'd be like a three finger day. That would be my relaxation response on getting home. Then I decided that maybe that's not the best way to relax. I decided that when I would get home, I would get on a yoga mat, do some stretching, do some breathing. Nice. It did the same for me without the deleterious artificial effects of the alcohol. You know, I think that's an example of how you know, alcohol, like food, can be part of people's relaxation routine.
Same with shopping. Same with, you know, I would even say cutting. I would even say, like, you know, anything that is going to help you numb the way that you're feeling. But what you said is, I needed to relax. You were able to identify that you needed a really nice way to relax, and you
switch
wanted
gears,
to
like a circuit breaker, like a circuit breaker.
That makes perfect sense to me.
But they're adaptive ways to relax. And then, of course, eating is kind of a maladaptive way. It's almost like forcing you into a parasympathetic state, you know, because once you shove a lot of food into your gut, you do feel kind of
100%.
Right?
100%.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that people, when you ask them what their self-care practices even look like, they say, I get my nails done and I get my hair done. I personally don't like to do either one of them, but I have to do both of them. Like, it really is like quiet time. Like, when do you, like, how do you unwind? You know, and like, that's really what you were looking for, especially when you're probably around everyone's energy and, you know, taking care of so many people, right? How do you fill yourself back up?
Well, I just needed to do a big exhale, you know, because then I'll let out a lot. Okay, so we're on to number
four. Rule number four is to get 10,000 steps every day. And so, you know, the average American gets less than 3,000. And we know that you need at least 7,000 movements or steps in order to really lower your risk of sudden death by 50%. Mm-hmm. And moving your body is really important for your circadian rhythms, your wake and sleep hormones, your mood, your digestion, and maintaining your weight. What I have found in my practice is that it's at least 10,000 steps. Mm-hmm. We have to start building in this practice the second, you know, you want to start even losing weight. Exercise doesn't help you lose weight, but it's, if you don't have this habit built in, you cannot sustain the results.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's what you said in the beginning, last hour, or last segment, was you can't run away from a bad diet. So you can exercise your brains out. And I see people, they can lose weight, but that's because they're just stuffing themselves with carbohydrates, you know, they're carb loading, and they think that the exercise is going to expiate their sins. Does it?
No. Our body thrives in consistency. And the more consistent we are, the safer our body feels, especially in this like environment of stress that we are all under now.
Well, you know, I think that 10,000 steps thing is a good idea, but I was just in LA for my high school reunion. And when I was walking around certain quiet neighborhoods, I thought that the neighborhood patrol was going to, you know, come up to me because it's such an aberrant thing. Everybody drives in LA.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I try and get out every day and walk a little bit, but you're right. Like New York.
It's a little bit of an oddball thing. See, in New York, I walk everywhere because,
so lucky.
Because it's faster than driving.
Yeah, true. You know, when I was in New York over the summer, and I realized New Yorkers actually drive slowly. So that's part of the problem too. Is like the speed limit's lower than California.
Because you can't. Everybody's double parked. Yeah. And you can't drive. You can't drive fast.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we're up to number five on your list of six attributes.
Rule number five is to drink 8 cups of water every day. And so, you know, there is such thing as too much of a good thing, but there is also something of not having enough, you know, it's just not enough. And our bodies are between 50 and 70% water. We have 100 trillion cells. Our cells are 43% water. We need to replace that. And that water, if we don't drink enough water, is actually terrible for our kidneys and our liver. And our liver's job is to metabolize fat, you know, triglycerides, cholesterols, and body fat. So we end up storing fats when we don't drink enough water.
I just read a very interesting study, and I think it's a Japanese study, where they actually looked at the relationship between hydration and mortality. And they found that there was under hydration led to higher risk of dying. And then I think there's some studies that show that hydration is a hedge against metabolic dysfunction too.
Yeah.
Obviously you can't, if you're hungry, you can't just drink, and it's to supplant hunger, because hunger is real too.
Right.
Sometimes people have a false hunger that can be assuaged with adequate hydration.
Yeah. And I would recommend, if you can't really tell, always drink water, but hunger is not going away, mm-hmm. right? You'll know soon enough. It's like, you can't tell if you have to pee. You'll know soon enough if you do.
Yeah, I know. So these are both Paul strong drives.
Yeah.
And finally, number six, to cap it off,
is 7 hours of sleep. Average of man is getting 6.5, and we really need between 7 and 9. But right now we have a lot of problems with falling asleep, staying asleep, and waking up rested. And that, again, creates extra stress, and that tips off, you know, your adrenal glands, and it messes with your hormones and your insulin levels. And you can't maintain your weight if you're not sleeping.
Yeah, I always get extra hungry when I forego sleep. You know, especially when I'm traveling, I'm jet lagged. It's like, constantly looking for something that I wouldn't ordinarily eat at that time of day. So there's no question that it has an impact. You're out there in La La Land. You're in SoCal. And so you see a lot of, shall we say, celebrity clients. And, you know, these weight loss drugs are all the rage. So how do you put that together? You know, say you're seeing a client and they're on a weight loss drug, and you want to make the case that it's important, in spite of the efficacy of the weight loss drug, that you should adhere to all these principles. And is there some, look, people are going to eat less. And if they just say, I'm not really hungry, what's going to happen to their muscles if they don't get adequate protein? Where do you emphasize in diet with a little that they're going to consume?
Yeah. I mean, I do hope that it's not a little. I really do hope. Well, that's confusing, only because if you think about our metabolism, compare it to like a stovetop, and the stovetop has 6 burners. And somebody who's starting this medication, who I would believe may not have the healthiest relationship or history with food, and maybe has a high body fat, which tells me that they don't have all 6 burners on. So they're not actually as hungry physically as they are emotionally, let's say, mm-hmm. right? So the goal is to make sure that they've got all 6 burners on by the time we're done, or by the time that they're going to stop this medication, right? Which means that they have to lower their body fat, increase their muscle mass, move their bodies throughout the day, and eat small and often, but not a little. And so many people are like, proud of themselves. They're literally proud of themselves for not eating all day long and then having a yogurt for bed. This is not what we want to be happening. We want to be having a consistent amount of fuel throughout the day to feed ourselves. That actually causes your body to feel safe. And then it works on the entire system with blood sugars, and like all the systems work better when we are consistent with small and often. And so we will become bingers if we restrict.
Yeah.
If I restrict cake, and the next time I give myself cake, I'm overeating cake. If I undereat throughout the day, I'm going to overeat the next time, right? This is the way we go. But if we can safely eat every couple of hours, and we're packing it full of foods that are treating our body right, we're winning all over the place. And then we're moving our body, and we're sleeping, our inflammation's going down, we're more motivated to do things. This is how to do it.
I've heard, from some experts that, and with the popularity of low-carb diets, which I do believe in, I think, Atkins really launched a revolution, and I think there's a lot of evidence that we're consuming far too many carbs, and low-carb dieting really helps people. But I've heard that, especially for women, a very low-carb or ketogenic diet may not be so good, that it may increase stress to some extent. Is there something to that?
You know, I actually think Dr. Atkins died of a heart attack.
No, actually, a true story, because I knew Dr.
Atkins. Yeah, tell me.
He had a cardiac arrhythmia, some maybe atrial fibrillation, maybe ventricular something. He was on a blood thinner. And it was, you know, Dr. Atkins was kind of a bull in a china shop. So he was like racing along on an icy sidewalk. He slipped. He was on a blood thinner. And he had a major brain bleed. So, I mean, ultimately, that was the, you know, like the foes of the, you know, high meat, high fat diet say, aha, you know, the guy, you know, his diet killed him.
Was a slip, not a heart attack.
Yeah. I mean, look, he might have had a drop attack where he had cardiac arrest and then fell, but nobody really knows. But to say that the diet did him in is, I think, a disservice to him. But the point I was getting at is that are there different nuances to low-carb dieting for women and men? Is there some thing?
No. What I really think, I think men have just as unhealthy relationships with food as women. If not, you can also, you know, the statistics on young boys and adolescents who have eating disorders is, I think, almost equal to girls at this point. And like, we really have to be careful. And so when we use words like low carb or high protein, very confusing. And I would rather start with, are you hungry even when you're eating?
Okay.
And are you choosing foods that agree with your body? So anytime
that we're focusing not so much on the macronutrient ratios, you're focusing on the eating behaviors.
I don't think it's necessary to focus. It's kind of like we got to put everybody in kindergarten, but we're trying to advance them to senior year. Mm-hmm. And we can't really build this relationship with food when the foundation is not solid, right? And so first figure out why you're even eating. And then figure out, does the food even agree with me?
Yeah, that's so much harder, though, than to say to people, don't eat any carbs. You can eat as much as you can eat cheese. You can eat eggs. You can eat, you know, souffles. You can eat your porterhouse steaks. As much as you want. Forget about your eating behavior. And you'll still lose weight. I think that appeals to people.
I want people to lose weight. I want people to stay with the weight loss. Mm-hmm. And so we have to actually change and build these new habits. Mm-hmm. While they're losing weight, right? The side effect of the change is the weight loss. Mm-hmm. That's what we want. We want somebody to say, not willpower. I did it for a week. I did it for a month. I want someone to say, I have so much power in what I believe, and I feel so good that I'm not even going to go back to that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes, that really comes when they accept exactly what's going on.
Do you agree with some of the health gurus who say that, particularly as we age, and if we're on a weight loss medication that restricts our caloric intake, that it's very important to focus on adequate protein to support our muscles so that we don't develop sarcopenia? Is that a thing?
I think it's yes. I think it's a little overblown, mm-hmm. only because protein comes in all of our vegetables. It comes in all of our starches. Comes in our milk sources or yogurts.
Perhaps and not as complete.
Our
not
meats.
As complete. Yeah.
Right. But it does come in all these sources. So we're getting so much protein, hopefully enough. Again, people on these medications may not have had a healthy relationship with food. So you're talking about people who were addicted in one way or another to eating, you know, too much steak or too much popcorn or too much ice cream or too much cake. And so now, with this, you know, leptin and this slow down digestion, they're eating less. And now I'm hoping that people will be mindful. And there is protein in a lot of these foods. But I think we have to be very careful, because using the words like eat a little bit or low or high, very confusing to people who have, you know, been traumatized by diet culture. But
sounds like you are not the kind of medical nutritionist, dietitian, who says there are good foods and there are bad foods. You should never have a cookie or a piece of cake, you know.
No way.
Because that actually engenders this kind of bifurcated thinking that can actually kind of lead to disordered eating. You know, it's not what you would tell to a small child, for example. If you want a child to develop an eating disorder, you raise them that way. Right.
I mean, there is going to be, I mean, who knows? I might want gelato when I go to Europe. I may not, I don't need to know the answer to that, right? But I don't want to be restricted from it. I may want a crepe, I may, you know, want ice cream next week. So I don't think food is bad, but I do want people to honor the way their body feels. Right. I think this is the most important piece.
But you don't want to sit down with a quart of Häagen-Dazs if you have like a, you know, an argument with your husband or something like that. Or
Well, that would be eating for an emotional reason, yeah. Right? And so if you're actually following the rules and you're eating when you're hungry and you're sitting down with Häagen-Dazs, you now only have permission to start with half of what you normally would. There is a fail-safe built in, right? And anytime we eat less than we normally did, our weight is going to fluctuate. The goal is, can I be consistent in this? And, you know, I have a story about a young boy. He was overweight and his parents brought him to me and he went to a restaurant, a diner called Bod's Big Boy every Friday night with his family. And every Friday night.
That's an LA thing, you know.
Yeah. He asked for a shake every Friday night. And his parents, again, had brought him to me to lose weight.
That's kind of a calorie bomb right there. Yeah.
Yeah. He had about, I think, 20 pounds to lose. He was 10 years old. And I said to the parents, it's really not ideal if he grows into his weight. You don't even worry about the weight loss, but let's just focus on give him the shake. Let's see what happens when he has the shake. And his parents said to me, and you're going to freak out when you hear this. Well, we want him to have the hamburger and french fries. He can have the shake after the hamburger and french fries.
Hey.
And I said, well, let's just try the shake and forget the hamburger and french fries, which, you know, they're in quotes thinking that's the healthier option at the diner. And I said, let's give him the shake and see what happens. It took 2 weeks of me convincing the parents to allow him to have it. And you know what happened after the boy got the shake? He no longer wanted it.
Right.
He realized.
The forbidden fruit. I mean, obviously, yes. That's what happens. Yeah.
Yes. And he stopped having it. And as soon as we have permission to experience how it feels in our body, then we can grow.
You know, it's a lot of these things are more exciting in the contemplation than in the consummation.
So
I think what you say actually makes a lot of sense. And so much of dietary advice is based on the good food, bad food model. But surely, as a dietitian, you recognize that there are such things as UPFs, ultra processed foods, which are not good for us. And I think we have to make choices that we, you know, while we may permit ourselves, some of those, on certain occasions, that generally the regular intake of those things is not.
I would rather somebody see that ultra processed food in their pantry and it expires than to feel like they can't have it. I would rather them no longer reach for it because they know that the carrots or the radishes.
The food doesn't love them. The food doesn't love them.
Yes. And so putting shame on the food or sensationalizing it isn't going to let anybody like off the hook. There is going to be a time when I'm hungry and maybe chips are my only option and I'm going to be really super grateful for a calorie, right? That's going to happen. I mean, I've been stuck at the airport before. I've been stuck on an air flight. Then it happened. And
I've had to make those choices over the past few days because I've been traveling a lot. And, so I made the best choices under the circumstances. They weren't that great. I checked into a Subway and, and it had certainly to sustain myself. So, yeah.
And the healthier your gut is, to be honest, it takes those noxious chemicals and it eradicates them. We don't have to worry about it. If we're consistently eating them, we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds reasonable. Any final words of wisdom to people who are on these weight loss drugs? You don't discourage them from trying them. They act to some extent as trainer wheels to enable us to acquire better habits. What else do you have to add?
I think my best advice to anybody and everybody would be that they're the hero in their own story and that they can do it. They can do it. And maybe they haven't in the past, but they can do it.
Okay.
It can be hard things.
Well, it sounds like you are an excellent coach in that regard. You've helped countless people. And your new book, This Is What You're Really Hungry For, contains a lot of wisdom. And it's actually among diet books, and I put them in Dr. Evil quotes, it is a bit of a standout because it's not about eat this, not that. It's not like the plant paradox, which is basically, eat a carnivorous diet or, some of the diet books that tell you become a vegan. It's not about what to eat. It's sort of how to eat. How to eat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why to eat.
Indeed. Okay. Well, that's a breath of fresh air in this very, very congested world of diet books. So I advise people to take a look at it. The source of all the usual places, Amazon, etc. This is what you're really hungry for. And your website?
It's at Kim Shapiro Method.
Do you do telemedicine? Because a lot of our listeners are there all over the country. And so
I think primarily now, yes, it's mostly telemedicine at this point. Just way more convenient.
Yeah, actually, one of my classmates is a psychologist, and she says, does exclusively telemedicine now. COVID changed the whole field. So you're available throughout the United States and the world, and you have clients all over the place, I'm sure. So that's great. All right, Kim Shapira, it's S-H-A-P-I-R-A. Your website, kimshapira.com.
Method.com.
Okay. Good stuff, Kim. Thanks for your wisdom on this, and keep up the great work. Best of luck with your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover intelligent medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything intelligent medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.